Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unofawaken.
This week, the British NSA snoops on millions of webcams, Apple's CarPlay, Google's modular cell phone, Microsoft's version of Siri, Facebook to launch drones, the selfie that broke Twitter, and much more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com. And you can leave us a review there on iTunes. And also, you can all of our subscription links are in our weekly show notes. So go there. You can write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. We'd love to hear from you. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show is on Stitcher at Stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Last week, we announced that we were going to have Matt Hawkins, president of Top Cow Comics, on as a guest. He had to unfortunately reschedule, but we will have him back on an upcoming show, so stick around for that. I don't have anything that I've been playing with this week. I didn't ask if you guys did.
I have some.
Yes.
It is not new. I just got a Logitech PS3 Harmony Bluetooth adapter. Do you guys know what that is?
Is this the thing that lets you control your PS? This is the thing that lets you control your PS3 with a Harmony remote.
Yeah, with your universal remote.
Yes, I have one of these. They're terrific.
Exactly. It's one of those things, like an infrastructure piece of tech you buy.
Yeah.
I think it costs.
It's needlessly expensive.
Because it's like they're the only guys who make it.
Yeah.
It used to cost like $60-something or something, but because the PS3 is, you know, on its way out,
sure,
I picked it up for like $30-something on Amazon.
Yeah.
And what it does is, if you have a Logitech Harmony remote, which is, I think, by most standards, it is the best, most versatile universal remote you can have out there. You set things up by activities. So you say, watch a disc or watch TV, and it basically puts your TV on the right input, puts your speakers on the right input from your receiver or whatever.
It creates macros of actions based
on your devices,
on the activity that you want to perform.
Exactly. It's mostly, you know what it is? It's like a recipe. It's like IFTTT's recipes where the ingredients are your devices. So anyway, thing about it is that in the end, it is an IR remote. It is it's a infrared remote. The PS3 doesn't have an infrared receiver.
Nope.
Because Sony was like, who needs that? The thing came out, it was $600, and they couldn't put an infrared receiver.
I think they did it intentionally. I think they did it by design. Because all the other appliances, entertainment devices that came out around the same time as the PS3, they all had infrared receivers.
Yeah. It was unclear what's up. Anyway, this is the bridge device. What it does is, it will take in your infrared signal, and it will it's sort of like hardwired to talk to the PlayStation 3 and behave like that. Now, why would you want this? It's a game console. But for me, it's mostly my Blu-ray player. So now I don't have to get up and press the button to turn on the Blu-ray player and yada, yada, yada. It's like complete laziness. Would laziness cost me – was laziness worth like $60-whatever to me back in the day? No, but it was worth $30-something today, especially because I was just watching the Oscars like everybody else, and they mention a whole bunch of movies you haven't seen. So what do? I hop on Netflix, I get the discs, I put them at the top of my queue, and they show up. So for the next several weeks, you know, my partner and I, she's going to be accompanying me on some 2013 movie journeys, and it'd be nice if I didn't have to do everything myself.
I will say that it is kind of a little costly for what you think you'll get out of it. But I use it almost every day, so yeah. It's in constant use at my place.
Yeah, I think the rule, most people say the rule is, you know, spend money directly proportional to how much use you'll get out of something.
Right.
This is, again, one of those things that you're not going to see. In fact, I don't even see it every day because it's in a TV cabinet that I have that, you know, it's getting signal from the IR blaster, which, you know, the sensor is hidden, you know, next to my television set. So I'm not actually, like, seeing this device ever. What I really am seeing is the... What I'm really getting is the functionality, which is worth it. Anyway, so that's the new thing I got. It's been a godsend. I don't have to, you know, get exasperated when my girlfriend can't figure out how to get the Blu-ray thing working, yada, yada, yada. So that's my story.
Before we get into, like, this week's new headlines, I want to wrap up some updates of stuff that we talked about last week, in particular the Bitcoin, the fall of Mt. Gox, that was the hot topic last week.
Not the only thing to fall, it seems, in the Bitcoin realm.
No. But as far as Mt. Gox goes, they filed for bankruptcy protection last Friday. And in that filing, they revealed that about $500 million in Bitcoins had been stolen, compromising $750,000 Bitcoins deposited by users in the site and 100,000 owned by Mt. Gox themselves. And they reported that they didn't know what technique or techniques attackers used to steal the Bitcoins, exactly how many were stolen, or when the thefts occurred.
So they reported 500 million. It could have been as low as 300 million, but they're just trying to cover their ass when it comes to bankruptcy protection. Yeah. They've got assets to pay. They've got people who are going to come after them as creditors.
Absolutely.
It's a hot mess.
It is a hot mess.
Yeah, I was speaking to somebody, a software engineer who's working on an exchange for cryptocurrency. And he, you know, it was obviously after the fact, but he had mentioned he had a couple of reasons why for him Mt. Gox had never been a place to really trust. So it's interesting to see that the fall is this big, you know.
Yeah.
It also goes to show that in an age of basically, we're in the cryptocurrency Deadwood of the world, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's claim jumping and all the things.
The Wild Wild
you
West.
Associate with the Wild West.
The pre-FDIC era of Bitcoin.
Exactly. It's and you know, I don't think cryptocurrency is going to go away. But I would say that cryptocurrency is a big risk right now. So if you don't have the resources or you're not comfortable putting your resources in this, you really want to avoid it because you just don't know what's going to happen, and there's no bailout coming. You know,
cryptocurrency has its detractors and its supporters. Last week we talked about it's one of its detractors, Senator Joe Manchin, who wrote a public letter to financial regulators asking them to, quote, take appropriate action to limit the abilities of the highly unstable currency. Later on last week, venture capitalist Fred Wilson responded to Senator Manchin's letter. He wrote, quote, "The volatility of Bitcoin relative to fiat currency should be expected in a nascent and emerging technology. What's amazing, however, is its resiliency in the face of massive scrutiny, company failures, fraud, theft, and a host of other challenges it faces as it becomes mainstream and mature. When something as new and different as Bitcoin emerges, it's tempting to want to put the genie back in the bottle and protect ourselves from it. But thankfully, the U.S. did not do that with the internet. The impact of the commercial internet on the U.S. economy and society as a whole has been massive and overwhelmingly positive over the past 20 years. We should approach Bitcoin in exactly the same way. And if we do, I expect the benefits we see will be equally important, impactful, and beneficial to our economy and society." So, Fred Wilson, one of the top venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, speaking out in support of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what's going on. You can't run away from the future. You know, ducking our heads in the sand and saying, this isn't for us, or people are too stupid to understand it, yada yada yada.
Yeah.
That's not going to help us move forward. That's the way that's going to link the U.S. to getting passed by on this. We're risk takers. It's what we do. It's what we did when we came to this country. It's what we did when we had the gold rush. It's what we did when we went to space. Like the Cadillac commercial says, we left the car there because we're the only ones going back.
I love that ad.
We are risk takers. And part of risk taking is, you know, it doesn't always work. But if enough of us are taking diversified enough risks, as a nation, we're going to move forward. So call me Mr. Patriotic Tech Guy, but I'm bullish on Bitcoin. I'm going to stay that way.
All right.
I just don't expect
it is interesting, though. Like, in some facets, we are risk takers, but in many others, we're not. I mean, one of the areas that you see this is with our credit cards, right? So our credit cards are still primarily swipe-based credit cards, right?
Yeah, that's a cheap thing, though. That's not a risk-taking thing. We all knew that the chip thing was better. It's just that it's expensive, and we're cheap people. Bitcoin doesn't really cost to get in, right? It costs if it doesn't work, but it doesn't cost to get in. Like, infrastructure costs, that's something that we don't do well. That's why our phone technology was behind Europe's for like 2 decades. Our cell phones, just... So, like, I would agree that we're not always in the forefront of everything, but it's usually tied to what the cost-benefit analysis is. The fact is, it was only recently that credit card companies started seeing these massive hits on their card issuing banks, started seeing these massive hits on their consumers' card numbers, and now we're looking at that liability shift in October 2015. You guys know about that, right?
No, the liability shift in 2019?
2015. October 2015 is what's going to be called the liability shift. Right now, when you have these massive credit card fraud situations like Target, Neiman Marcus, whatever, basically the card issuing bank, so if you have a Capital One Visa card, the card issuing bank is Capital One on the Visa system, the card issuing bank basically takes the hit. They're like, shit, man, all right, whatever. It's the cost of doing business. I'm gonna take the hit. I'm gonna, you know, be responsible and just eat the costs that these fraudsters use. Mm-hmm. Now, the liability shift is when the card issuing bank says, okay, there's been a hack and people's stuff is taken. We're gonna take a look at the entire chain. So, you know, someone bought something off of Amazon, right? And then Amazon used this proprietary or off-the-shelf, e-commerce software to process this. Mm-hmm, and tunnels were this and so on and so forth. And then it got to, you know, this third party, and then it got to us. Who was the weakest link? The liability shift says, I'm shifting liability from me, the card issuing bank, to that weakest link. So that weakest link will have to pay, which is an incentive to have everybody not be the weakest link. And that should basically like highly limit the ability for credit card fraud to happen, which consequently should limit the ease of corruption around most of the Western world, because a lot of organized crime and corruption comes from credit card fraud.
Well, that is an interesting point. I think I definitely do agree that, you know, maybe that is the case. We are innovative yet cheap. That's we can characterize a portion of the U.S. But I definitely do think, as you said, you know, maybe not Bitcoin per se, but this sort of currency is here to stay, be it Bitcoin or some other iteration of it. And I think we should take steps to make sure that it is safe, that it's viable, rather than, you know, hiding away from it until it, you know, gets into your backyard and you have to suddenly sort out all the problems associated with it that were never, you know, planned for.
Okay, moving on here. And lastly, in a last bit of Bitcoin follow-up news, another Bitcoin bank has been forced to close after hackers stole 896 Bitcoin. worth about £365,000 in an attack last Sunday. FlexCoin was this bank. FlexCoin was robbed of all the coins in their hot wallet, which is basically all the coins that were connected online. They also had some bitcoins in cold storage, keeping on devices that weren't connected to the internet, and those bitcoins are safe. So there we go. Bitcoin, the Bitcoin Wild West days of bank robberies does not seem to have abated. I think right. We're still in it.
I wonder if the federal government does anything regarding, like when the bank thing happened back in the history, mm-hmm. when like the bank robberies, Bonnie and Clyde, you know, they basically made it a federal crime to steal from banks, and they went really hardcore on the punishments, like 10 years minimum or, you know, whatever that is. I wonder if that's if that kind of deterrent is going to show up around Bitcoin, or if it's just going to really be a free-for-all.
Yeah, I don't know. I think at some point the Japanese government is already stepping in and starting to regulate Bitcoin.
But not even the regulation of the Bitcoin, just saying if you steal it, you're going to get, you know, bad duty.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, trying to default the regulator.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to be a while still. We're still in that Wild West era.
Yeehaw.
Did any of you guys see the Oscars this last Sunday?
Yeah.
My CEO was at the Oscars.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What? How did that?
It was very funny because we just randomly stumbled on photos and uh-huh. videos of him in the background.
Oh. Wow. Who does he know? That's like an invite only thing, and it's hard to get tickets because there's so few seats in the Dolby Theater.
I guess everyone's into the cloud.
Yes. Everyone's getting paid somehow or some way by some sponsor, apparently, because during the Samsung-sponsored Academy Awards, host Ellen DeGeneres wrangled celebrities from the audience to tweet an awkward selfie with her Samsung Galaxy Note 3.
Was it awkward? It seemed pretty not awkward.
Well, you know, the thing is that she was doing this a lot. She was doing it a lot with, and they were, these little Samsung sort of selfie breaks were meant to seem organic, but they really did not feel organic at all. They felt forced and...
I think they felt as stiff as whenever any 50-year-old says, I want to do a selfie.
But sort of like the telltale, like one of the telltale signs that this was a sort of forced viral campaign was that she was also tweeting pictures from backstage, and for those backstage pictures, she was using her iPhone. So
interesting, yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah,
the interesting thing to me was, you know, I watched the Super Bowl this year streaming from my iPad, right? Mm-hmm. I saw the Grammys over the air, and when it came to the Oscars, ABC, which has an app and an Apple TV and an iPad, iPhone app and an Apple TV app and all this other stuff, they did not stream the Oscars at all. Even though Samsung was pretty much the exclusive sponsor of it, and I'm sure Samsung would have been like, hey, stream it everywhere you got it, just play my ad over and over again.
Yeah.
They had this thing called Backstage or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And basically, you did not get the live commentary and all that stuff. You basically got shots of random, I guess they're celebrities in the audience, yeah. And they're laughing.
Yeah.
And a kind of Mystery Science 3000 reporter, you know, gossiping about it. It was awful. And I had to actually go out to the garage, find my cable box, and plug it in to the TV in order to satisfy my girlfriend who wanted to watch the Oscars.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I was using, like, ABC's had that app I know that they were doing like a second screen experience for the Oscars, but I could not get the app to work. I couldn't get the stream to
it would stop every once in a while. They certainly had bandwidth problems. But here's the thing. A second screen situation, if it has live video on it, you cannot hear both screens.
No.
I don't care who you are. If you want to give me metadata about what's going on, that's great. But the whole I'm going to show you another stream of video and you're going to be sitting in front of your TV that has video, that seemed like an unhappy experience for me. I mean, the second level of video, the second backdoor, it was shitty video with bad commentary, bad camera angles. It was a lot of bad stuff. Yeah. But even so, the idea that I'd have to like try to listen to two things at once, that was kind of painful.
Right, because, I mean, in general, humans are terrible at multitasking. And so, especially when you're bringing other sorts of video and audio into the picture.
Rich content,
Yeah, exactly. Which content do you purely focus on? I could see a second screen experience if you are going with more, you know, images and more static content. You know, maybe that's better. But if you really think about it, sometimes the second screen experience is really there to avoid boredom from the primary screen.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. For sure.
That's what it's like. Okay, the primary screen is getting a little slow. Let me check out the second screen. So you pull it up. I think this is great when it comes to the NBA and basketball games. You can see like which shots have happened, or the MLB with baseball games. This was the pitch. This was that. This was the other thing. And you're just kind of like, oh, okay, that's cool. I get to like kind of see that. But you're not getting like color commentary that's, you know, not tied. And it's always tied to stats, which are an easy thing to follow up on, just like how you pull up the Wikipedia when you're watching a film or a TV show.
Yeah. In any case, the official Ellen DeGeneres' official tweet was a selfie of not just her, but a number of other celebrities, including Bradley Cooper, Jennifer Lawrence, Meryl Streep, Julia Roberts, Kevin Spacey, Brad Pitt.
I think you got that wrong. It wasn't Jennifer Lawrence. That was Miss Piggy.
Wow.
Ouch.
The views have of you not do not represent the views of...
Have you not seen that Jennifer Lawrence and Miss Piggy are the same person?
I have not seen that.
And this is the word pig is where people get upset.
You're talking about the attitude, like, right?
She's not fat.
Uh-huh. That's sort
Miss
of like
not fat. It's just that face. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Interesting.
Miss Piggy, Jennifer Lawrence.
And the dress.
I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Right. It's like LaToya Jackson and Michael Jackson. You never saw them side by side.
I will say. So why were people retweeting this photo?
Because she said so. Because she asked for it to be retweeted, and it was retweeted more than 1.3 million times, which beat far
by the end of the show 2 million times by now.
Yes. So if Ellen told us all to jump off a bridge,
what are you?
Well,
eating?
See, it was a social experience. And people
Barack
now
Obama.
Now it's 3.2 million retweets, by the way.
There you go.
Tally.
See, Barack Obama had the most retweeted photo sometime earlier the month, right?
Yeah.
And Ellen was like, I think we can beat that.
It was the Barack Obama. It was the election retweet from 2012. And his photo was retweeted 781,000 times. So yeah, this beats his. By,
she was trying to beat the Barack Obama. She said we want to get.
But the idea was she was trying to get this picture retweeted, record-breaking picture. The ulterior motive is because it was sponsored by Samsung.
Maybe I mean like sure right, but the idea Ellen DeGeneres on her own was probably thinking about how to get the most out of the Samsung situation.
Yeah.
And the fact that Ellen's like on her show doing silly things, messing with the culture, this is totally in line with who she is as a comedian, public persona. So I don't think it was like Samsung dictated this to her. I think they gave her a phone and said, go do what you got to do.
Right.
The big thing for me is I'd like to put that tweet in context of the net worth of the people who are in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling it's probably the most expensive tweet by hours made, you know, dollars made per hour for all the people yeah. in this.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, for sure. a history-making tweet, really, if you think about it. Because when do you have that many celebrities of that caliber in one photograph? So
whenever you have the three of us in the same room.
There you go.
Yeah.
okay, moving on here. So in other bigger, more news of more import, Britain's surveillance agency GCHQ, with aid from the U.S. National Security Agency, intercepted and stored the webcam images of millions of internet users not suspected of wrongdoing, according to secret documents. These would be the Edward Snowden documents. GCHQ.
Wait, this was Putin? Putin's doing this?
No. GCHQ is Britain's version of the NSA.
Oh my God, the Queen. That
yes.
dirty little lady.
Files dating from between 2008 and 2010 explicitly state that a surveillance program codenamed Optic Nerve collected still images of Yahoo webcam chats in bulk and saved them to agency databases, regardless of whether individual users were an intelligence target or not.
This is why it sounds so much like Putin, right? You go to the Olympics, they're like, hey, man, don't expect any privacy. Now, they've got the Iron Ring in yeah. London, but at the same time, you don't expect a free-loving society to be checking out your webcams. And the thing about this is how many of the images they got, they think they were snapping the picture every 5 minutes. A lot of these chats were like sexually suggestive or explicit
yep.
chats
yep.
with people being naked. And the government kept it anyway.
Yep.
They were like... Yeah, so we're just going to keep these pictures of random innocent citizens, well, innocent in quotes, touching themselves on their webcams and call it, chalk it up to surveillance. Like that to me is a little strange.
Yeah, like what is the purpose behind, how do you justify that?
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to say, I'm tracking your email, I'm doing whatever, I'm not happy with it, but it's one thing to say that. It's another thing to say, I've got snapshots of you naked in your private moments from your webcam when I know you were active on it, and I'm just going to hold on to those. Because while it's sort of like, well, what else should they do with them? This is the kind of stuff that another administration in Britain or anywhere else
yeah.
could very much use when they recognize someone's face to blackmail them, to strong arm them.
Yes.
To take
the old
J. Contact.
Edgar Hoover strategy.
Yeah, you know, like, this is the kind of thing where it's like, I saw you doing this.
Yeah.
You know, you want to run for that MP position? I don't think so. You want to like, challenge me on this thing? I don't think so. We'll expose you. And that's where it gets sketchy, especially when it's literally, you know, aside from Canada, the closest ally the U.S. ever has. So they're supposed to be somewhat like-minded, and that's sketchy. It also asks, you know, begs the question, was this happening in the U.S.?
That is a good question. I don't know, but, I think a good sort of guideline is when you're not using your webcam, face it away
yeah,
from the room.
This was taking the images also while the people were using the webcams
yep.
on yeah. the Yahoo.
Yeah.
The Yahoo chat. So that's what makes it so painful. You were actively using it, and we decided right then we were going to copy your stuff and chase you down. And it's kind of like... I don't know. It's a little worse
it's
for me.
It's disturbing.
Yeah.
Very disturbing. All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the leading world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to talk to you about this week is called Minecraft, The Unlikely Tale of Marcus Notch Pearson and the Game That Changed Everything by Linus Larsson and Daniel Goldberg. Either of you guys play Minecraft?
No, Chris Brenor is crazy about it, though.
Yeah, I used to play it a lot back in the day. I haven't played it
back in the
much.
Day. It's only been around for 3 years.
Well, it feels back in the day. Right. You know? I've been aging quickly since building an R2. But, I mean, what I will say is, funny enough, last night a group of friends and I we reflected on all the major projects we made in Minecraft, and we're walking through some worlds. So.
I have a friend of a friend who has created the entire, all 12 districts of the Hunger Games in Minecraft.
I thought Facebook was a waste of time.
Well, this is like a kid who's, you know, I think he just turned 13, so he has a lot of free time on his hands.
So here's actually something that we've done in Minecraft that's been pretty useful. So as you guys know, I do attend a gaming convention called PAX, Penny Arcade Expo.
Sure, yeah.
And we do some sort of crazy things, a group of people who I associate with, for example, the Lando Society and other things. Mm-hmm, and as part of our planning stages, whenever we have recruiting open, we need to show people where we're going to be in the different spots. So to make this life easier, we recreated both convention centers in PAX so that when we do our walkthroughs, we can actually physically walk through the building.
That's genius.
Well, yes and no. I mean, couldn't you just like overlay a layout of it, or perhaps even like drop Google Dots, or in the future use iBeacons?
So that would be if we were all on site and sort of, but being all around the world, right? There are people from everywhere. It's just easy to start a stream or allow people to log into the server to actually get to experience what the convention center is, as well as building out the surrounding area too. So it's kind of useful if you've never gone to PAX, you now have some sort of reference.
So this book is about Marcus Notch Persson, the creator of Minecraft, and in it he opens up for the first time about his life, about his old Lego-filled desk at school, about the first computer his father brought home one day, but also about growing up in a family marked by drug abuse and conflict. But above all, it's the story of the fine line between seeming misfit and creative madman and the birth of a tech visionary. And that book can be yours for free by joining Audible. You get that book for free, plus the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And to download that, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that audiobook. Even if you don't like the Audible service and you want to quit it, you still get to keep the book for free. And it's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown once again. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Apple takes Siri out on the road while Microsoft gets its own Siri. Take a listen to this. And come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Adafawakin. Apple has rebranded its iOS in the Car initiative as CarPlay and unveiled Ferrari, Mercedes-Benz, and Volvo as the first partners to build it into their websites. Now, we remember CarPlay when they originally announced iOS in the Car at the WWDC conference last year.
2 years ago.
It was in 2013.
2013 iOS in the car. I guess Siri in the car was 2012. 2013 was iOS in the car.
Yeah.
It just seems like so long ago because car technology moves so slowly.
They rebranded it this week at the Geneva International Motor Show to make it clear that the CarPlay was the in-car equivalent of Apple's AirPlay technology for the living room. Apple's Siri virtual assistant technology is key to the initiative, acting as the interface for drivers to access their contacts, make calls, listen to voicemails, while also reading out messages and responding to voice commands. Apple's map service will be a key feature in CarPlay 2, with routes shown on the car's own screen and spoken turn-by-turn directions. Digital music is also part of CarPlay, but not just iTunes, but also Spotify and iHeartRadio are among the third-party apps that will work with it. A company says that it also has deals with 13 more manufacturers to integrate CarPlay into the future. So, looking good. You know,
finally, a great upsell for a vehicle.
Yeah.
I mean, I was at a software company last year, 2013. It was a smart radio company, basically figuring out ways to make it so that when you listen to the radio, you can do things like enter a contest on your phone instead of trying to call in, so on and so forth. And when you begin looking at the options for this kind of functionality, like good functionality in the car, and when you look at like how the car manufacturers look at things, the manufacturers are struggling because the young people buying cars now, the younger versions of the millennials, they're sort of like, I don't care about horsepower. I care about miles per gallon and my phone interface. I think the Honda Fit just has a Bluetooth connection. That's it. Your phone, They have an app and a Bluetooth connection, and your phone is the console. So one of the things that's important here is that they make it so that you can get that good in-car experience. And the fact is, the software engineers at car companies are never going to figure that out well. They can hire everybody they want, but the fact is they should be looking to make the driving experience great, mm-hmm. and they should be looking at the people who deal with modern mobile technological devices to get the best out of that. So they should be leaning on Google. They should be leaning on Apple and saying, hey, guys, help me so that I can get the best in-car experience for the operating systems that matter the most to these people who I want to buy these cars. Now, they've already tapped Microsoft on the Ford side. Unfortunately, Ford and Microsoft, they have an exclusive deal. So Microsoft has its hands tied with, you know, the best domestic car manufacturer with the most reach, you know, Ford, but they're still tied in. What Apple and Google are doing with Android in the car and CarPlay is far better for both stockholders, shareholders, for both car company and tech company, and for users. The idea that you can go up and say, I want to buy that car and I want Android in the car, or I want Google in the car, or I want Apple in the car, iOS in the car, CarPlay, whatever you want to call it, that's great. That gives you choice. And it gives you something that's going to integrate. And I have a feeling that if you go in there and you say, I want Android in the car, it's not just going to work with Android, but it's going to work the best with Android, right?
Right.
And it may be vice versa with iOS. So using these companies to really get that great in-car experience is going to drive sales, I think, really. The question is, I mean, Mercedes-Benz, Ferrari, these are very expensive vehicles. Microsoft did make the right choice when they went with Ford because you can get a lot done with Ford, right? Mm-hmm, Ford mm-hmm. has a lot of distribution. I mean, how many Italian mass-produced cars are there on the roads? I think Fiat is the only company that does that. I know Apple likes a high-end look and everything, but let's face it, iOS is not the high-end system. Everybody and their mother's got an iOS device, and everybody and their mother should have access to iOS in the car if you want iOS to be adopted more and you want people to do more things with it. And that's where I'm a little off on the whole, like, let's go with Mercedes and Ferrari. Especially because Mercedes-Benz is having a hell of a time, keeping youth consumers where Audi is concerned.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice for the first launch of CarPlay. But maybe it's because these vehicles are associated with the high-end market and Apple is trying to cultivate that sort of high-end
It's so aesthetic. Weird, though, because the thing is, iOS has leveled the playing field. It used to be that if you were wealthy, you got a fancy phone, you know, like something like back in the 90s when the Matrix came out, you spent $400 on that phone with slide down, whatever. But now, you better believe, if Ellen DeGeneres is backstage on an iPhone, and I'm sitting here with an iPhone, the only status associated with the iPhone is whether you have the latest one or not. That's the thing. It's a level playing field. The best phone in the world is accessible to all. So this kind of system, you would think if they really were thinking, you know, in terms of like getting the most kind of traction, making that accessible to all. And I get it. You start with the big guys and see what happens. But I have no doubt that Toyota, Honda, Subaru, GM, and others would have been just as powerful to show that, you know, they've got that. They've got iOS in the car. You don't need Ferrari for this. In fact, I think Ferrari doesn't help at all.
So, you know what's actually kind of interesting about this is, for one, I think it's kind of surprising that, you know, Google hasn't made a greater play at this as well, too, given, you know, given people's preference to use their mapping system, among other things.
Yeah.
And so you would think this would be huge for Google, you know, in addition to, you know, driverless cars, but having all this sort of functionality baked in. But the other thing to kind of start considering nowadays is one of my colleagues who has like a Pebble and used to set up his phone with the Bluetooth in the car. And now,
are you talking about me?
No, I was not talking about you, but
I'm that guy. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, one of the things that he's running into is just so many Bluetooth devices and not enough channels, quote unquote. Right.
Well, you can do. I have a Pebble connected to my phone while in the car, and my phone is connected to the car as well.
As well as he also has things to a device that monitors, you know, gas mileage and everything with the car as well too, plugged in.
Yeah, there's that device you can plug into your little kind of like data socket, and it can send data. But the, so you can connect to that as well, because it's possible to do all. I found that it's possible to do all three on my iPhone 5S. The thing about it though is that once you do that, you do have to do a little bit of managing on like what's doing what, right? So like my Pebble can change channels change songs, on the phone, on the car, basically on the phone that's playing to the car, but so can the car. And there is a time every once in a while where the phone would get confused as to where the output should be, yada yada yada. So you do have to think about that. Bluetooth is interesting because I've always loved it. But it's only gotten popular in the last like 2 or 3 years. All these companies had Bluetooth in their phones, but only geeks used it. Now it is a default, a de facto standard. And it's going to show up as a problem as there are more devices that want to be connected, especially for your battery. Another reason why these cars really need to have some sort of like innate docking procedure, Star Trek style.
Yeah. Yeah. Bluetooth, I think, is a great docking, you know.
No, I mean a docking procedure,
like a physical
for charging
docking
your phone. Yeah, because you walk into your car and you've got your Bluetooth car, right? You've got your Pebbles on, so it's using energy anyway. And then your buddy has, you know, the car socket data collection device that's also Bluetooth. You're gonna get to your destination and your phone's gonna be at zilch unless you've plugged it in.
Yeah, or road trips. I mean, if you think about it, what would be awesome is, you know, those sort of charging stations where you place your phone on it, but not something that you have to lie your phone down on. Maybe something that
there should be a dock. This is what we talked about in the break. This idea that your car should have some place where you put the phone. And if it's got a great system like CarPlay, then fine. It could be a place where you don't see the screen, right? As the driver, you put it in a thing, and it connects the power, and boom, you're off. But another thing is, there are plenty of like third-party things you can stick on your car, like attached to your vents or whatever, and they're all ridiculous. And when I say ridiculous, I mean like the kind of thing that Steve Jobs would call junk. A good car that has this kind of like sync solution should also have a solution for physically placing your phone in a place where it can get power, be powered up, and connect to your car without having to be a whole to-do, you know?
Ease of use.
You should walk in like you have cup holders. You should have a phone holder or two, one for you, one for the passenger, maybe. Especially because I know my car has 4 Bluetooth portable players available. That's important because 2 people drive my car, And the fact is, you might be on a long trip and you've got a friend who's like, oh, I want to play a song. He should be able to connect his phone too, yeah. Without having to like pull out a long cable or cord or whatever.
I agree wholeheartedly. You know, like,
yeah, I mean, there just should be. I drive to the mountains almost every weekend this time of year. And sometimes we get stuck on I-70 for hours at a time. And I have to think about curating content. No, we're going to listen to the radio now because we don't have enough podcasts to get us home. Now, there are people with other stuff, and they need to be able to, like, connect quickly and do it. That's one of the tricky things with Bluetooth. Most devices don't allow for multiple connections. Logitech has a speaker that will remember two devices. They can play off one another. But the cool thing about CarPlay, it sounds like, if it's anything like AirPlay, it doesn't require you to do a whole bunch of pairing. If you're in the space, you can connect, and that's what's tight. That's the kind of thing that my mother would use, that my girlfriend would use. Not necessarily the women in my life, but the people who are less into tech than I am and who have less patience for having it. Is it connected? Am I paired? Did I put in the code? All that nonsense.
All right, let's move on to the next topic here. We got a lot of little topics to go in this break here. This was an article that I read in Time magazine. I thought it was really interesting. Amongst the initiatives that Google's Advanced Technology and Projects Group have been announcing, one in particular is quintessentially googly. It's Project Era, which aims to reinvent the smartphone by breaking it down into modules that can be assembled and customized in a limitless number of configurations. They first disclosed that the project existed on October 29th of last year, but last week they lifted the veil further as they prepare for an Aura developer conference they're holding on April 15th. And a year from now, or so from now, they hope to have a product on the market. Now, how this works is essentially, like, right now, if you buy a smartphone, the odds are you get something that's that one of a handful of large companies designed to appeal to tens of millions of people. For example, like when Samsung announced the Galaxy S5 this week, its headline improvements included a better camera, fingerprint scanner, heart rate monitor. In the world of modular phones, you might be able to pick any or all of these features and add them to the phone you already have. You'd even be able to pick amongst multiple cameras or choose quirky features not meant for the masses.
This is taking me back to the handspring visor with the expansion pack on the back. Remember that?
I'm gonna have to look that up because that's not immediately coming to my mind.
There was some of the guys who created Palm came out with another handheld device called the Visor.
Uh-huh.
The Visor had basically looked like a Game Boy type cartridge slot on the back.
Uh-huh.
And that was for specialized equipment modules designed to work with the handheld. They were effectively trying to make a typical tricorder, a medical tricorder or whatever.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
Plug something in there, it's got sensor inputs or whatever it's got, specialty hardware, and the software would talk to your handspring and you'd be able to do stuff with it. In fact, back in the early 2000s, they had a module that was a mobile phone. It was like one of the first truly smartphones. It was a handspring visor with that cartridge in the back, and the cartridge you put in there was a cellular device that gave you cellular connectivity. So it was a smartphone. Palm eventually bought Handspring and the Visor product and integrated their solution back into Palm. So the people who started it had left Palm. Palm loved it so much, they bought it. It got integrated, and its legacy was evident in, you know, many of the Palm smartphones. But one of the coolest things about it was modular. You had a cartridge, and that cartridge wasn't really a cartridge. It was a slot that had, you know, data input, some sort of proprietary serial input for whatever specialty hardware you had.
But I guess the odd thing about this, and maybe goes back to what you said earlier, Duane, at least in America, we're pretty lazy, right? So how many people do you think will actually take advantage, or do you think it's going to be a fad for a period and then people will just take the cookie cutter design that they see that's most popular online?
I think it ties into a couple things. One, if we're not going to subsidize phones anymore, which seems to be the way
wireless
companies are going, then you're not going to want to spend crazy money on, you know, $400-$500 on a phone every 2 years. If you can stay current by just buying...
swapping out a module.
That'd be great. If you could stay current by just, like, I'm just going to buy a new camera because the new camera came out. Or, you know, I feel like I need more memory. I'm going to swap out a memory, the storage module or whatever. Or I'm going to go on vacation, so I want to get that new camera module. If you can get more out of your device, you're going to do that. The question is, though, do we trust the people who are making this? How many Google devices are stuck on the original operating system, right? They're not getting the update. So many of them still use Gingerbread when, you know, KitKat's been out for a while. So they're going to have to work really hard to make the infrastructure powerful. They're going to have to work really hard to convince people that the phone itself is a platform for multiple devices. And they're going to have to convince developers and hardware manufacturers. And hardware manufacturers are difficult to convince to make products that sit on this platform, this hardware platform. Those are big challenges. But if they get that done, the idea that you can have a phone that you change piece by piece over 7-8 years, that's damned cool. If they can keep the connection interfaces as consistent as, let's say, Apple kept the 30-pin connector for a decade, and hopefully Lightning will be around for a decade. Then,
well, they use a standard like a mini USB connector for
the mini USB. The mini USB connector has been around for, you know, several years as well. I think that they're going to have something that has a bit more snap to it than what's currently out there. But if they can stay consistent with that form factor and sell modules, it'll be as powerful as the iPhone accessory market is right now. And that is a powerful market. Because everybody knows that when a new iPhone comes out, it's going to be around for 2 years. And it's, you know, the actual life of the device is going to be 4 or 5 years. So all these accessory makers, third parties, run out to make clock radios that you can dock it with, or things for your car, or, you know, waterproof cases, because they're not worried about it changing. They're going to have to find a way to get a form factor that allows people to gain access to connect different devices to it. It's not going to change. They need consistency.
I'm excited about this. Whenever, you know, they're planning in 2 years to have production models out. Hopefully it'll have some sort of design aesthetic that doesn't look like I've seen examples online of concept modular phones that look basically like Lego, like handheld Lego bricks that other bricks are.
Well, it's going to get messy because if you have third parties making modules, they're going to want to do their own thing and stand out and all that stuff. Yeah. So it's going to not be the neatest thing, but there's, you know, the cream will rise to the top.
Sure, sure.
Places like the Wirecutter will be like the best camera module for your Android GX58, you know? And you'll go out and you'll get that.
I don't know. I think I'm still sort of skeptical. I think, you know, it may be cool to achieve, but I don't know. I just don't see all these organizations working together and finding a profitable means of spending their time. But, I mean, only time will tell, so we'll see.
Yeah, I think it's a good direction to want to go in. I don't know that it's going to take off, but it's a good direction to begin moving in because there's something to the fact that you should be able to expand your phone. A little port at the bottom isn't enough.
Yeah. Okay, moving on here. Microsoft's upcoming Windows Phone 8.1 update will include Cortana, a personal digital assistant designed to rival Siri and Google Now. Sources familiar with Microsoft plans have revealed to The Verge how Cortana looks and operates, replacing the built-in Bing search functionality on Windows Phone 8.1. Do you guys know where Cortana gets its name from?
Why don't you tell us?
the Halo game series, where in that game Cortana was your personal assistant, your virtual avatar personal assistant that would pop up and help you out along your quests. So I think they picked a great origin for a name for this. Cortana takes the form of a circular animated icon in this case instead of a female character. It will animate when it's speaking or thinking, forming a personality not dissimilar to Apple Siri. And just like Siri, it'll allow Windows Phone users to set how they want to be addressed by the voice-activated assistant. Cortana can call users by their name or nicknames like Master Chief after the function is enabled in the settings. A key part of Cortana is its ability...
So I can get it to call me Dwizzle?
Yes, if you want.
What do you mean? Of course I won.
or you could get yourself, you could be Chief Dwayne of Household Winterfell and in the lands down under.
That would take a long time because it sounds longer than Dwizzle. Maybe Dwizzle Rex.
I kind of like sticking to the default Master Chief. That's kind of fulfills.
But then everybody's little... Master Chief.
It's that's
like when
true.
You walk into the
that's
supermarket true. And you're like about to check out, and everyone's at the checkout machines. And for some reason, they thought it was a good idea to have every single checkout machine have the exact same voice. So you don't know whether right. it's you or the person next right. to you who has to reweight that thing or rescan right. that thing or has too much stuff in the whatever. It's so annoying.
By the way, this is a total sidebar here, but there's an initiative being proposed by the former head of the group LCD Sound System. He wants to change. They're changing the ticket stalls in New York City subways, and he wants to be a part of that in order to make it so that instead of all making this sort of soulless antiseptic beep sound, that they all have different sounds from the same sort of chord, but like different
variations on the same chord. Yeah.
So that when you're going through the turnstile, it's a very sort of melodic, harmonious sound as you're going through. And once again, every turnstile will have its own individual tone, so that once again, like you were talking about the supermarket checkout aisles, you can tell them apart.
Yeah, it's very important to have that kind of machine acknowledgement that its interaction is with you and you alone, and not with it's not, you can't confuse it for something else. This is a big part of what makes us feel validated when we interact with the machine.
Yeah.
It's reacting to me and not just to some random stimulus that anyone can give it. That's going to be a big piece of the future as we get more and more automated devices as a bigger part of our lives.
Right. I feel like we're slowly sidling towards Her, the Spike Jonze movie.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Add it to your list.
I will say that the fact is, we are all afraid. We've all seen that commercial or that movie where the world was just a whole bunch of human drones. Right. And the more the technology could help us feel as if we're individually making a difference. That's why the connected self, quantified self movement is so big, because technology is telling you about yourself. Mm-hmm. It's helping you become a better self. When it interacts with you and it says, hey, you did this, or hey, you swiped this, or oh, please go ahead, or whatever, the Nest Connect Protect is telling you it's smoky in here and not just doing some random beep.
Right.
You feel better about your interaction with that machine, which makes you feel better about yourself.
Yeah. Let's move on here. In other Microsoft news, Microsoft is currently experimenting with a free version of Windows 8.1 that could boost the number of people using the operating system. Sources familiar with Microsoft plans tell The Verge also that the company is building its Windows 8.1 with Bing, a version that will bundle key Microsoft apps and services. Early versions of the software have leaked online. The Windows 8.1 with Bing is an experimental project that aims to bring a low-cost version of Windows to consumers. What do you think about this idea of Microsoft offering a free or low cost version of their OS? I know Mac is already, obviously Mac is already
chasing
done it with,
Apple on this.
Yeah.
I mean, what they've done is Apple's OS X has basically gone from you get a couple free upgrades and pay $30 if you want to move it forward, to if your device is supported, every year you'll get an upgrade and your device has a lifetime. Microsoft, mm-hmm. when they created Windows 8, initially dropped a $40 entry price for anyone who wanted to get in early. I bought one of those. You downloaded it onto a memory stick and you can install it on any one machine you want. If they can hang out at $40, they'll be okay, because expectations are that these operating systems for Microsoft cost $120 or more. But if they can get down to $10, $15, that's really where they're going to see – that's really where they're going to cork off some of the bleeding that they've seen. And people are going to feel like they're getting the most. Because what they need to do is focus on being on every type of machine and having people give their data to them via their use of the services. So, yeah, you get on there and, you know, Microsoft Word or whatever version of Office is available right then and right there. So you're not losing out to Google and you're not losing out to Apple with iWork. And people are using your system and you're able to collect data that can then be used while you're fingerprinting machines or whatever to, you know, talk to advertisers or figure out diagnostic usage or whatever you need to do to get real value out of understanding how people are using your machines. Because right now, you know, this model of pay us crazy money for a program or an operating system isn't working, especially because people don't like a lot of the changes they've made recently with Windows 8, and they're sticking with those Windows 7 boxes. So they really have to, you're going to tell me to spend crazy money on Windows 8 and I'm not going to like it because you've changed it that dramatically. You know what? I don't need this. I'm going to use Google Docs because it's always the same.
You know, here's a question for you. Do you think it would ever make sense for Microsoft to pivot or at least have an OS that's dedicated to business rather than sort of this mismatch that they sort of have at times?
I don't think so, because what they did in the past was they had a super hardcore operating system and they would dumb it down, right? So off it, like Windows Enterprise, they strip out some stuff, Windows Professional, strip out some stuff, Windows Home, strip out some stuff, Windows Basic, right? Or whatever derivations of that are. OS X, on the other hand, you get an operating system, and if you really need some stuff, you can add the server element to it. But for the most part, it is what it is, what it is. And that means that every program that's on it, every function that's on it, can be used by any person who buys that without them having to worry about which operating system they're getting. Microsoft created a lot of confusion when you can sit there and say, hey, look, I got this game from 1998 that I wanted to play on my new computer. Oh, I have to have this version of Windows because it virtualizes. My version of Windows doesn't. Like, you don't want that. You don't want people having to think about or worry about or anything what they can do on the computer, because all the computers should be the same, whether it's your computer or your friend's computer. So they really need to make it so that there's that. And then when you get to work, it should be so familiar, you're just ready to go. More importantly, in an age where offices are buying laptops for their employees and they don't mind if their employee takes it home, that employee starts to use their work laptop, you know, in some ways, not always, but in some ways, like their home laptop or whatever computer they have, by basically, you know, I'm going to check this out on the internet. And they don't want that to be, you don't want that to be a different experience if you're trying to get people to adopt your stuff. People should go to work, like what you have so much, they want to go out and buy it for themselves. Or the other way around. I like what I have at home, why can't I have that at work?
Yeah, that's essentially how the iPhone took over Enterprise.
Exactly. I mean, the BlackBerry was the Enterprise operating system for the mobile devices. And I don't know how many banker friends I had that had an iPhone and a BlackBerry in their pocket. Some of them still do. And they just, you know, they'd be like, well, I wish I could have this at work. And Apple eventually, you know, stepped it up and got their security together and voila. But really, Tosin, I think the thing is you want an operating system that people feel comfortable with across everything. I think in an ideal world, everybody would own their own computer and the offices would say, okay, well, you have to put this software package on it for the purposes of whatever kinds of private communications you want to have with your computer, but it's your computer, do whatever you want with it. That would solve a lot of problems.
All right, moving on here. Now, this is a really interesting story. Facebook, one of the primary backers of the Internet.org initiative, which aims to bring affordable internet access to the 5 billion people of the world who still lack connectivity, is in talks with a company that could help further that agenda. TechCrunch is hearing that Facebook is buying Titan Aerospace, makers
of... Is that owned by Vladimir Putin?
No, but it could be. Titan is the maker of solar-powered drones that can supposedly fly for 5 years without needing to land. And so the Facebook wants to acquire this, and the price is going to be $60 million. And Facebook is interested in using these high-flying drones to blanket parts of the world without internet access, beginning with Africa. They'd start by building 11,000 of these unmanned aerial vehicles that can conduct most of the operations of an orbital satellite, including communications, but are cheaper and more versatile.
Are they cheaper and more versatile than large balloons?
That's right. That's the Google initiative, the Loon.
Google solution to the same issue.
Yeah.
I have a hard time believing that any device with moving parts, so assuming these drones have, you know, little propellers that move them forward, because they're based on electricity, so they're not, like, unless they're converting some sort of, like, photons into gas for jet turbines, they're using propellers to move forward. I have a hard time believing any propeller is going to go on for 11 years straight without any service or anything. So that's, if they can do that, that's awesome, and my car should last for at least that long. but for the most part, I mean, it sounds like a pretty interesting idea. $60 million is cheap when you compare it to what we've been seeing for tech companies that make far less tangible devices than solar powered aerial drones. It's kind of the thing where, you know, I'd like to see them try, if not buy them, have a partnership with them. If not, Amazon's going to buy them and have these guys drop off things at my house.
Yeah, a little parachute.
In either case, it's a win-win, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or Google will buy them and say, I need more robots. Like, I truly need to build Skynet, and a solar-powered drone is exactly what I need to take over the world.
It's actually kind of interesting with the whole drone the whole drone market space, given that we don't really, it's another one of those things like Bitcoins where there's no real policy around it.
Yeah.
It's as if
not yet.
The thing about drones though is that unlike cryptocurrency, drones are really real, right? Drones are killing people. drones are flying around. Like, you can build a drone. You can build a drone yourself. So
sure.
Drones to me are slightly more exciting. In terms of, like, I can see that now. I mean, obviously, FAA's got to get involved. Obviously, none of us, especially, like, I don't want the Boulder sky, like, as I said before, littered with little black dots of drones everywhere. But if it can fly high and you know, provide us with, like, mobile cell towers, that's some shit.
Yeah, but I just think that it sounds as though it's going to come to this head where we're going to be way far along down the road, and then the government will realize, I think it's time we should actually put some policies into place rather than thinking ahead.
Because you can't just have, at least, I don't know about Africa, but, you know, the countries on my continent all have different rules, and they're really about a business. But at least here in the U.S., you know, the FAA has got a lot to say before you can even put something in the air, unless you want, like, with the exception of, like, a bottle rocket. Yeah. So I think that chasing down Africa, it's really a question of who they have to pay off to get the permit to fly the thing. And that's what's going to make that happen out there faster than it'll happen here. So I feel like that's it's just more real. You know what I mean, Tosin? Like, right. You go to Nigeria. I mean, Nigeria is actually doing pretty well on corruption right now. But you can convince the government that you'll give everybody connectivity and you'll pay for it all by just allowing things to fly in the sky. Like, you know that.
Yeah. It's a slippery slope though with stuff like this, because, you know, this is their stated claim, is they're doing this to provide internet access to those who don't have it. But who knows? I mean, these things could be used for anything.
Yeah, I mean, the government might say, okay, that's fine. I just need cameras on all those planes.
Right. That's what I mean. It's a slippery slope. All right. We're going to take one last break. And when we come back, our drill down video of the week is next. So take a listen to this and come on back.
We got to get together sooner or later.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuwakin. A couple more stories before we get to the Drill Down video of the week. Roku announced the Roku Streaming Stick this week, which manages to pack nearly all the functionality of a full-size Roku box into a device not much bigger than a USB flash drive. It's a version of Roku's old MHL-based streaming stick, but there are two major differences. It now works with any TV that has an HDMI input, and it's half the price at about $50. It's a major perk over the Chromecast, which is the obvious comparison to, is that you get access to all 1,200 of Roku's channels, which includes every major, nearly every major service, such as Netflix, YouTube, HBO Go, Amazon Instant, MLB TV, Showtime Anytime, and PBS, as well as a huge number of niche content sources. While the Chromecast has added some crucial apps since its launch, including HBO Go, Hulu Plus, and Pandora, it doesn't compare to Roku's sprawling and frequently updated library. I know for me, like, I was on the fence about the Roku 3 and the Chromecast, and I eventually ended up getting the Chromecast just because it was cheaper. But
yeah,
now,
you can't beat Google's price on this.
Yeah, yeah, no, $35.
I'm a little annoyed that this Engadget article does not show the device in the television set with the cable coming out of it.
Right, which is the same limitation as the Chromecast, yeah.
Like the Chromecast, like, it's luckily for me, my TV's USB connection is right there, so I use a really tiny cable to power it. I had to go out and buy that on Amazon myself. But the fact is, like, they show these sticks that you can just plug it in and it'll work, and that's not how it works. I'm happy this comes with a remote. That's sweet. $50 is a lot. I know you get, you're paying $15 more or whatever. In order to get access over the $35 that the Chromecast costs, in order to get access to Roku's content. I don't know that that translates to the consumer because Roku is not Google when it comes to brand name. If you tell me I can spend $35 on a Google thing that I can stick into my HDMI port and get like access to a whole bunch of stuff on it, that's cool. If you tell me I got to spend $50 for something called Roku and I'm not in the know, that's a lot less cool. So I really feel like Roku, if they're smart, they can find a way to drop the cost and make the money up on services.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I do like the fact that they do have a lot of apps, channels on.
They're amazing. You can search for a TV show and it basically does a Can I Scream It on Roku search across everything Roku does. Like Kevin Spacey says, I don't care where I get it, it's just story. So you're not you're not adhering as a consumer to any one thing when you're going Roku. You're just saying, yeah, I'm on a Roku, but the fact is, can I get it through Hulu? Can I get it through Netflix? Can I get it through Amazon? Can I get it through whatever? I just want to get it. And that's where Roku becomes really, really powerful. That's where Roku is good shit. So, yeah, I don't know. I just feel like Roku, Roku's got something there. This particular stick, I think the price has to come down for them to get super traction. Because word of mouth may not do it.
Agreed here. I mean, Roku used to have the name and power behind it, but I think it's kind of it's now a second class, you know, citizen according to the Apple devices as well as the Google devices out there. So,
yeah, I mean, it's just like no one, once Apple and Google came out with their own devices, the name Roku just kind of fell to the wayside. And Engadget can talk about it fine, but you're not walking into a store and seeing a Roku display. You know, you don't pull out a Roku device. You don't get on Roku.com. This is the power that those brands have over what may very well be a superior, but what is a superior product in some ways. It lacks integration. Maybe Roku could work with Microsoft to create, I don't know.
That's what they need to do, is team up with some with one of the majors.
Yeah, I know. And the thing is, Microsoft's already tied in with the Xbox One. Problem is, the Xbox One is still marketed as somewhat of a game console, and it's still like $400. If Roku and Microsoft could come together, that might be helpful for them, because this thing still—it's, you know—it's $50. It's basically 80% off.
Xbox One is $500, by the way. It's the PlayStation. Yeah,
so it's 90% off. The Roku stick gets you, like, you know, you can use your phone for whatever you want to do,
yeah,
and it's 90% less than the Xbox One.
It's kind of interesting to quickly consider, you know, what if Roku had actually sold itself out to one of these organizations a year ago or a few years ago?
Merged with not sold itself, but if Roku and TiVo had merged maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I think we'd be seeing some pretty powerful stuff.
That seems like a very natural team up, those two, Roku and TiVo, because those are both companies that are very strong, but not perhaps not as strong as they should be.
Right, like they're both in the cord cutting space and they're both pioneers in it. Roku's got the content fix. TiVo's got the connection to regular broadcast media. They could have really done something together. Especially because, remember, the playing field was wider. There was Roku, TiVo, right. Boxy, and then, you know, the PS3, obviously. Xbox 360 had some functionality. And then there were these connected TVs and so on. But, you know, once Samsung bought Boxy, that got taken out. Apple TV showed up and changed the game. Chromecast came out last year and really took a whopping out, like whipping out of the Apple TV because of the cost differential and the ease of like installation. I wouldn't be surprised if Apple's next Apple TV was in fact a stick. I wouldn't be surprised at all. Hmm. If it was a stick running some sort of A8 processor that can do, you know, everything, like make my coffee and shit, I could totally see Apple creating that level of tininess for a regular, you know, to go with some crazy 4K monitor they have.
Let us one more news story and then the video of the week. This news story I'm really excited about, and this comes courtesy of the British Journal of Photography. And that is the news that Getty Images is making 35 million images freely available to anyone for non-commercial usage. Senior Vice President of Business Development at Getty Images says that they're doing this in response to the fact that they're seeing the extent of online infringement. Everyone today is a publisher thanks to social media and self-publishing platforms. It's incredibly easy to find content online and simply right-click to utilize it. In the past few years, Getty Images found that its content was incredibly used in this manner online and not with a watermark. They are typically found on one of the valid licensing customers' websites or through an image search. And the vast majority infringement in the space happens with self-publishers who typically don't know anything about copyright and licensing and don't have the budget to support their content needs. And to solve that problem, Getty Images is they're launching the ability to embed their images freely for non-commercial use online. In essence, anyone will be able to visit Getty Images' library of content, select an image, and copy an embedded HTML code to use that image on their own websites. They'll serve the image in an embedded player, much like YouTube with videos, and that will include the full copyright information and link back to the image's dedicated licensing page on the Getty Images website. So,
and they get data about how it's being used.
Yeah.
They're not going to go out, find the image, and be like, oh, it's being used here and there. This way, they'll actually know how it's being used. They'll have a relatively good idea of who's using it, and they'll be able to tell how to move forward with this business strategy.
Yeah, yeah. I'm excited about this. I'm excited about the ability to utilize some of these images without having to pay for it, because a lot of smaller publishers like myself just can't afford that. And I admit that I've been guilty of right clicking and using images that I found on the internet without thinking about where they came from.
Oh, Annie, you need to find Jesus and stop that.
Yeah. So, but I think maybe for this episode of The Drill Down, I'll pop in a Getty image and use
Get
that
some
instead.
Getty.
Yeah. So I'm excited about that. And the last but not least, the video of the week. Now, maybe 2 weeks ago, we talked about the Comcast merger with Time Warner cable, and how that would be create the largest subscriber base by a vast margin, and basically like our attempt to sort of drill down into the gravity of that situation. But Funny or Die created a video last week that essentially boils it down very simply in a matter of a couple of minutes. I'm going to play this video for us now.
Good job, Todd. Hi, I'm Jonathan Brackel from Comcast. We've read your comments and complaints, and we know that a lot of you are very nervous about our merger with Time Warner Cable. So I wanted to talk to you today and let you know that no matter what happens, we don't give a fuck about you. Whether you're calling in for a service appointment for your cable box or wondering why your favorite channel disappeared, we don't give a fuck. That's what makes us an industry leader in terrible customer service. We don't give a fuck because we don't have to.
What?
Are you going to go to another cable service provider? Chances are we own whatever movie or network you're watching, so that's still money in our pocket. Of course, you could watch Netflix or Hulu. In fact, you should. We own Hulu. We also make Netflix pay us extra for streaming content, which means they'll probably pass those costs on to you. Bottom line, fuck you! From the people who answer our phones to the people who write our TV shows, we do not give a fuck. And we collect labor violations and lawsuits the way fat kids collect cookies. Seriously, Google it. They don't call us the Walmart of telecom because we smell like rats and pizza. They call us that because we don't give a fuck about you. I know a big merger like this can be confusing, but all you really need to know is this is who we give a fuck about, and this is who we don't give a fuck about. And you. So thank you for choosing Comcast. You don't have a choice. Hey, America, go fuck yourselves.
So,
I love that because it's just like, it's the most negative PR without lying, right? Like,
yeah.
I'm sure there's going to be a lot, you know, there's a lot of like Comcast writing a statement out, whatever. This is not representative of what we plan to do, yada, 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 whatever. But the fact of the matter is, that's how America is going, that's how America feels today.
Yeah.
It's not without good reason. I mean, everybody, like, my girlfriend doesn't hate anything. She doesn't hate anything, and she hates Comcast. it's like a reaction. You walk into a room at your office and, like, hey, what do you guys think of Comcast? I hate Comcast. Right? And
it's a social bonding.
Yes.
It's like Lent, right? It's like everyone would give up Comcast if they could. The fact is, Comcast has created such a bad rap for itself. They only themselves to blame. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Every month you see your Comcast bill and there's another random charge on there. Right? They just nickel and dime you to death. And you compare that to the fact that, you know, the outages happen. You don't know. Like, I get it. They're doing an astounding thing. They're making magic happen by having this bandwidth come into your home. But the fact of the matter is they're doing something wrong. And when Funny or Die grabs the zeitgeist and really represents it like this, it's fantastic.
Yeah. You know, plus comedy is fact-based. Like, there are facts about that they lay down in this video that are kind of true.
Oh, the only reason why it's funny is because it's true.
Yeah. So there we go. That's our episode for tonight. I'm going to go around the table here. I'm going to start with you, Dwayne, and ask you, where can we find your work when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Always check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DwayneD. And you can look for me on gplus.to/DwayneD. And I'm always here on the Drill Down.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, ircwebcast.blogspot.com, and other sort of my build activity at toastr2d2.tumblr.com.
It's coming along.
Yeah, I've got a new post I've been putting off, but yeah. A lot of my parts come in March, so
nice.
It's going to be a ton of work.
Nice.
I'm excited for it.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, Facebook and Twitter at MrBabyMan, and just do a Google search for MrBabyMan, and all my social links are up there. As far as the drill down goes, if you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about tonight or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on our site. Let the podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. Be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.